three, reel six. Can you tell me what the searcher did in and around Norway?
The ship was employed throughout the several months that we were in the North Sea area, along with other small aircraft carriers, raiding shipping on the Norwegian coast, the most significant of which was, with a force of six aircraft carriers, HMS Furious, HMS Victorious being the two larger ones, and four of these American-built converted merchant ship aircraft carriers, we raided Alton Fjord in the north of Norway with the object of damaging the German battleship Tirpitz. The raid was carried out very early in the morning, and the element of surprise, it appears to have worked, but the amount of damage was negligible. Certainly our planes weren't in a position to do any damage because they were only fighter planes, and they were there to escort the bombers and torpedo bombers from the larger ships. That was in the later months of 1944, I think, and it was an operation called Operation Tungsten. I'm not sure now whether we didn't attack that area again. I think we probably did, but most of the remainder of the time, when we were in the North Sea, we were going to Norway, staying about 80 miles from the coast, and the planes of the four aircraft carriers, which the other three and searcher, were raiding shipping up and down the Norwegian coast. Lots of shipping was damaged by them, but the most significant ship that the searcher sank was a German ship by the name of Black Watch, which I'm not sure if it was a former British ship, but certainly by the name it sounds as though it might have been. But that was towards the end of the period when we were in the North Sea. It was an uneventful kind of period because it was just, we had by this time taken the offensive against the Germans, and it was a case of going up and down the coast, as it were, finding out what we could attack. Whereas years before, we would have kept well even further away from the coast for fear of the German heavy ships which were around.
Did the searcher come under attack at this time?
Not as far as I'm aware on those trips. We had other incidents where isolated planes appeared, but we weren't actually under attack at all, as far as I'm aware.
Do you remember anything about your role on board at this time?
Well, at that time I was a yeoman of signals, or acting as a yeoman of signals on the bridge, and I was there, as it were, to supervise the efforts of the various signalmen on the flag deck and to handle signals which they brought up to the bridge, and it was my job to liaise between them and the ship's captain, reporting the signals, and also to take down in writing signals which he wished to send to other ships.
Do you have any memories of the captain or anything that happened on the bridge?
I don't think anything particularly. I remember quite vividly occasions when we were involved in rough weather, when the ship would crake and one wondered whether it was going to stay afloat, because it was a welded ship and they tend to move and you get all sorts of creaks. In rough weather it wasn't a particularly comfortable ship. The only time that I can really vividly remember was later, when we were going south, we heard a terrific clatter of gunfire, and there was no one around, and we wondered what had happened. And I was on the bridge on that occasion, and what had happened apparently was that the planes used to be fully armed when they were on deck, and in many cases they were armed before they came up or when they were struck down from the flight deck. And this mechanic apparently was doing something in the cockpit of the aeroplane. The plane's wings were folded, so that in fact the guns were pointing downwards, and he did something which caused the guns to fire, and they fired through a number of decks, right where the mess deck was, where everybody would have been lined up for their lunch. But fortunately, this was at about 11 o'clock in the morning, before anyone was there. And only one crew member was injured, and he was a telegraphist in a nearby office. That was probably the most frightening experience we ever had.
You mentioned the living conditions were a bit difficult.
The living conditions were difficult at first for me, well, for everyone, I suppose, because it was an American-built ship, and the ship was fitted out with bunks, which would be hoisted up, as it were, when not in use, on chains. And if I remember correctly, they were four high, so there was very little room between one bunk and another, and it was something that we hadn't at all got used to, because in the Royal Navy, we normally had hammocks. And from that point of view, it wasn't at all comfortable. We had a large number in the mess that I was in at first. And there seemed to be very little room for anyone to do anything. But later I got promoted, and after that, of course, I was in a different mess entirely with many more people. I was in a mess with over 140 petty officers. And although we had the same system of bunks, we did seem to have a bit more room. But food-wise, it was a cafeteria system, which I'd never come across before. And the food generally, perhaps, was a little better than what I'd had hitherto. Certainly it was much quicker to get served and so forth. But I didn't spend too much time below decks anyway. My job kept me in the open air, and that's where I spent most of my life.
What were the weather conditions like? What was it like being on the upper decks?
The weather conditions, sometimes they would be quite good. Certainly they were much better than they had been in previous years further up in the Arctic. But it can get very rough in the North Sea. And when we ventured out of the North Sea, like on the occasion when we went across the Atlantic, we had terrible Atlantic storms, and the ship didn't behave at all well on those occasions.
In what way?
Well, the ship would pitch, and for anyone who was forward on the ship, not that I was, but anyone who was forward on the ship, would find themselves at one moment being lifted out of the sea, as it were, and a moment later plunging like having a parachute leap without a parachute. And it wouldn't have been very comfortable for those involved.
How do people move along the decks?
With difficulty on the flight deck, one had to be very careful in windy weather particularly, especially if the weather was adverse. But most of the movement through the ship was done below decks, as it were, passageways and so forth, where there's usually someone to hold on to.
Any other memories of life on Searcher?
Not particularly more than any other ship. It was a ship that was on board for about 2.5 years, and it was a great experience for me, really, because I started off life on board as a leading signalman, and eventually, when the war ended, or before the war ended, in the VE Day was in May 45, the ship then went to the East Indies, and immediately we got there, the Chief Yeoman of Signals was drafted ashore to the signal establishment in Bombay as an instructor, and there were three yeomen on board, of which, of course, I was one. And by the stroke of good fortune, if you might say, I found myself being assigned to the chief petty officer's mess at the age of 20, and yet I was the youngest of the three yeomen. The reason I was assigned, because in the Royal Navy, in those days anyway, the idea was that if you had the same seniority as someone else, you would be considered senior if your initial came before his in the alphabet. Now, as it so happens, I had, from that ship, been to HMS Mercury at Hampshire and was doing a Yeoman of Signals qualifying course with another of the three who was on board. He had served with me in my previous ship, the Norfolk, and he was a very senior leading signalman in those days. He was about 6 years older than me. And he, because he completed the course at HMS Mercury, his date of seniority happened to be the 1st of February, 45. I, because I wasn't able to complete the course through a bereavement in my family, I went back to the ship and I was sent to qualify for Yeoman of Signals in Belfast, which was a two-day examination. And that was on the 28th of January. So by 3 days, I was senior to this chap who had qualified fully in HMS Mercury. And the other yeoman, his name was Redrobe. And as his name started with the letter R, I was senior to him. So I got moved to the chief petty officer's mess. It was a ship, well, I always remember, started off virtually at the bottom and reached the top in 2.5 years.
What did that mean in terms of your living conditions and your responsibilities?
Well, the responsibilities were simply that all the signalmen, including the other two yeomen, were considered to be my inferiors from the point of view of orders. And the messing was a little bit better insofar as it wasn't nearly as crowded. I think we had about 30-something chief petty officers in the mess, whereas I'd been in a mess where there'd been over 140 petty officers. And, of course, it was much nearer to where I slept and also where I worked, which was very satisfying for me.
Tell me about your role as a chief yeoman.
Well, the chief yeoman normally spends most of his time on the bridge of the ship, and the yeoman of signals normally supervises the signalman on the flag deck, or they, in some cases, they relieve the chief yeoman on the bridge if he goes for a meal or something. But the responsibilities were fairly reasonable on that ship, because very often we were on our own. But when we were with other ships, it became quite a demanding job.
So would you be the first person in the signals branch who would receive messages or signals from the captain or whoever?
I was there to take messages down, signals down, which were dictated by the captain, and then I passed them to the appropriate quarter for them to be transmitted. I didn't normally get involved in reading signals and recording them, but I used to read everything that went on, and before it arrived from the flag deck, I was able to tell the captain what it was all about.
So you were really at the heart of the ship?
Well, it was the point at which knowledge was disseminated, if you like, from the captain to other ships or to parts of our own ship, and it was also the focal point to which all messages ultimately arrived, so that one was very much in the know as to what was going on.
And were there any occasions when for example, when the Tirpitz was attacked, that you were involved in that?
Well, we did get signals from other ships about the reports of their aircraft, etc. And so I managed to get information which others wouldn't normally see, but the messages weren't addressed to me. I just happened to be the link in the chain which handled them. There were quite a lot of signals exchanged between the ships at sea all the time, whether it was in an action condition or not. There was always fuel reports every morning from the other ships to the senior ship to say what the remaining tonnage of oil fuel was, how much water they had on board, or anything else they wanted to report. But there were regular reports made all the time that the ships were at sea.
How did you spend your spare time on the searcher?
Spare time. That was something I didn't have very much of, except in harbour, of course. In harbour, I would do like most people did, go ashore and perhaps have a drink or go sightseeing or something like that. But on board the ship, there wasn't a lot of leisure time. There was for some people, but not for me.
You said you were in search for 2.5 years?
About 2.5 years, yes.
Which would take us to 1940?
I was on board the searcher from March 43 until November 45.
Where were you when peace is declared in Europe, May
45? In VE Day, the ship was in Scapa Flow. And in fact, for what reason, I don't know, but HMS Searcher was anchored very close to the wreck of HMS Iron Duke. Royal Oak. Just near Kirkwall at the north end of Scapa Flow. That was when we heard that the peace was declared in Europe. And I remember we went ashore into Kirkwall that evening, and there was after a short time, there was very little beer left. But that was the first time I'd ever landed in Kirkwall, and the last, of course. After that, we then went off to the East Indies, and we were there then until after VJ Day, which happened to be my 21st birthday.
Can you remember anything about the East Indies part of your service? Can you remember anything about the East Indies part of your service in the searcher?
The which part?
East Indies.
Oh yes, in the East Indies we spent quite a bit of time doing flying practice from Trincomalee, and indeed on VJ morning we were doing flying practice, and we had a crash on deck which caused us to cease flying for that day, and then of course we got the news of the war being over. And after that, I think it was the next day, we embarked 600 French Marines at Trincomalee and took them to Rangoon. It had been rumoured that we were going to go to Singapore, but for some reason that was changed, and we took them to Rangoon and brought out the first batch of repatriated Allied prisoners of war and internees from Rangoon, of which there were 365, I remember, half of whom were Indians, and the other half were troops from the British Isles, a lot of them being Scotsmen. All the Indians practically had lost a limb, but the British troops appeared to be in a better shape. We took them to Madras and disembarked them there, so that the British troops could have a few days of rest and being fed before they were flown home.
You mentioned a little bit about the condition of the prisoners or released prisoners. Can you say anything more about that? Is there any...
They were all obviously had been ill-fed, and the Indians were very showing signs of ill treatment. They had various limbs, almost every one of them had lost a hand, an arm or a leg or something like that. And they were, the only place to accommodate them was in the hangar, for which long rolls of jute matting was laid, almost like a hospital ward. And they had to sleep on camp beds. All of them were in the hangar. And I remember this vividly. The first meal they had on board was supper, and it was curry. They were on board, I think, for about three days or something. And during that time, they experienced what it was like to be on an aircraft carrier in rough weather.
About that time in the East
Indies? No, it was a fairly uneventful time, really, from an action point of view. The action was mainly in Europe, but by the time we got to that part of the world, the Japanese were well clear. There may well have been submarines around, but it was again a case of doing flying training and practice to keep the airmen fit and happy.
Having come from the North Sea, how did you adjust to the difference in weather and climate?
Well, that wasn't a problem, really. Having spent most of the war in the Arctic and North Sea, it was a treat to go to somewhere where it was warm. In fact, I get badly affected by the sun, and so I had to always wear a handkerchief tied around my neck to stop the back of my neck getting burnt. And earlier, I was the only one on the ship who used to wear a pith helmet, like the Royal Marine bandsmen do. No one else ever, I never saw another sailor wear one on the ship, but I had to, because I lived all the time on the bridge where it was punishing to be in the sun all the time. Even today, I don't go in the sun.
Were you issued with any special kit for the trip?
Oh, yes, we had tropical kit, white shorts, short sleeve white shirts, white shoes, white stockings, of course. We never wore that in this country or in Britain, but it was issued for. Everyone is issued with that in the Royal Navy anyway. But then when we went out to the foreign climes, as it were, we may have had extra kit issued for the tropics. And of course we had white suits as well for use in climatical conditions, mainly for parades and so forth. But the normal rig was white shorts and white shirt for the chief yeoman. The rest of the crew might have been in blue shorts and blue shirts, but the chief yeoman was always dressed as the officers were, with white.
What was the state of discipline aboard the Searcher?
Well, it was a little bit different than most ships, because the crew was largely made up of what they called T124X ratings. They are ex-merchant seamen, or were merchant seamen, who had signed the contract to serve with the Royal Navy in wartime. They didn't appear to understand discipline in the same way as the normal sailors did. Nevertheless, they all got on with their jobs, and we all got on very well.
When you say that they weren't perhaps as disciplined as conventional members of the Royal Navy, what do you mean?
Well, members of the Royal Navy, especially if they were trained at HMS Ganges and such establishments, they learned the art of discipline from a very early age. Merchant seamen do not, they may have a discipline in the Merchant Navy, I'm not suggesting they don't, but they don't have the same kind of discipline as Royal Navy men do. And they get on a different pay structure, and they have a different attitude to what the regulars had. Mind you, there were very few regular Royal Navy men on the searcher, very few.
So were they actually paid less than regular?
No, they were paid more.
Paid more?
They were paid more. They were paid danger money, as it were, in addition to their normal pay.
Can you give me any examples of disciplinary problems with the...
Not really. Most people at some time or other, as it were, fell foul of the law for various reasons. Sometimes you would get someone who was insolent to his superior, or smoking when in an improper place or something like that. All sorts of things. Being late back from shore leave or something like that. But generally, the general discipline was very good.
Did you ever get into trouble?
Yes, I was in trouble on board the searcher, actually. The problem was that my chum, who I'd trained in the Navy with, he was stationed as a signalman, or as a leading signalman, on one of the signal stations in Trincomalee Harbour. The fleet were in, there were no end of aircraft carriers. I can't tell you how many there were. There were lots and lots of ships there. And there were three, if not four, jetties to be landed at. I remember one was called Mustard Pot Jetty. Another one was called Pepper Pot Jetty. We were landed at, I think, Mustard Pot Jetty. And, of course, everyone except me made a beeline for the canteen. I went to the signal station where my chum was. I'd already said that I was landed. I'd signaled to him. And I went up there and spent a couple of hours with him. Well, during my absence, apparently, an order was issued that the crew of HMS Searcher were to return from a particular jetty. But no one told me, because they didn't know where I was. So consequently, I went back to where I was landed and found myself stranded. I managed to get a lift with someone else, and of course, as a result, I was back on board late. I had the utmost difficulty in explaining just how it was that I didn't know, being a yeoman of signals. I should have known, so they thought. But it was all right. The case was dismissed after the captain got to hear about what had actually happened.
So you were brought up on a charge?
Oh, yes, I was brought up on a charge.
Can you tell me about that process?
Well, the process of being placed on a charge is that one, first of all, sees the officer of the day, or officer of the watch, as a defaulter. If he thinks there's a case to answer, he then refers it to the commander of the ship. And you go before the commander, removing your hat on arrival. If the commander is not entirely satisfied with the explanation that is given him, then he puts it before the captain. And in this case, for what reason I do not know, it arrived before the captain, who was quite happy with my explanation.
Does that process take place immediately after you...
Oh, no. No, one normally sees the officer of the watch sometimes on the night. I can't remember whether it was that night, but more often than not, it happens at about 8 o'clock the next morning. And then the commander's defaulters may take place later the same day or even the next day. But it's a tedious procedure. And if you're innocent, you still have the tedium of having to go through all the rigmarole, if you like. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the system, but you still have the inconvenience of having to go through this system, as you describe it, when you know perfectly well you're innocent.
What could have happened to you if you'd been found guilty?
Well, I would have probably had 7 days leave stopped or something. They wouldn't have worried me because at that time we weren't getting leave very often anyway.
Would it have damaged your future promotion?
Not really, no.